From 90.9 WBUR, I'm Chris Sidorek, and this is Radio Boston. Coming up, will the Globe's investigation finally put to rest questions about Senator Elizabeth Warren's heritage?
My family is my family, but it is clear my family background had no effect on my being hired anywhere.
Plus, on Labor Day, preparing for a future of work that will include robots. Northeastern University President Joseph Aoun says colleges have a critical role.
I think the higher education has the ingredients, and the whole idea is to put them together in a different way in order to make people robot-proof.
iRobot founder Rodney Brooks says we need a reality check on the possibilities of robots.
It turns out artificial intelligence is really, really hard, and we hardly understand anything despite what some people say in the press.
That's all coming up next on Radio Boston. This is Radio Boston. I'm Chris Sidorek. It may be Labor Day and a holiday for many people, but here in Massachusetts, political candidates are working overtime, with less than 24 hours to go before primary day hits tomorrow. For many, that included a stop at the Greater Boston Labor Council's annual Labor Day breakfast, which drew most of the state's key Democrats, including U.S. Senator Elizabeth Warren, who's facing a challenge in November. Warren will face the winner of tomorrow's Republican primary, either State Senator Jeff Deal, Republican activist Beth Lindstrom, or businessman John Kingston. Warren didn't mention either one of them and instead focused on Republicans in Washington, who she accused of doing too little to help working Americans.
And do you know what my Republican colleagues say? They say, we don't have the money. And I say to them, you know why we don't have the money? Because you insist on giving it away to billionaires and giant corporations. That is wrong. It is wrong.
WBUR's senior political reporter Anthony Brooks was at this morning's event, and he joins us now. Anthony, welcome back to Radio Boston.
Hey, Chris, good to be here.
So let's start with Elizabeth Warren, a major story by the Boston Globe yesterday regarding her claims of Native American ancestry. That's been an issue that has followed her for years since she ran against Scott Brown back in 2012. Tell us about the story, what they find.
All right. So the big question that the Globe was trying to answer was, did Warren use her claim as Native American ancestry as a way to advance in her high-powered academic legal career? And to help answer that, Warren herself handed over reams of her own records to the Globe, and reporter Annie Linsky did an impressive bit of reporting on her own and concluded decisively that no, her ethnicity or her claims of ethnicity played no role in her academic career. It found that throughout her career, from the University of Texas to UPenn to Harvard, she was considered a white woman and an academic superstar who really rose on her own merits. Now, it's true that after she was hired, she listed herself as Native American in some campus directories, and that in some cases the schools apparently counted her as Native American. But according to dozens of people, professors at Harvard, among others, and elsewhere interviewed by the Globe, none of the hiring decisions took that into account.
So, as I mentioned, this is not a new issue for her. She's been dealing with this for years, all the way back to 2012 when she ran against then incumbent Senator Scott Brown. You asked her about this and about the timing of this story today. What'd she have to say?
Yeah, that's right. I mean, I wondered why she didn't release all this information before. So I asked her, why now? Tell us about the decision to release all this information of the Globe. And here's a bit of what she said.
I finally got all of the documentation and put it all together, gave it to the Globe. They then did their own independent investigation and made it perfectly clear that, look, my family is my family, but it is clear my family background had no effect on my being hired anywhere.
So, Chris, you heard her say, my family is my family. And what she's referring to there is that her understanding that she has some Cherokee blood was family-based information handed down to her from her grandmother, from her mother, from her aunts. She also told the Globe that she wishes she had been more mindful of the distinction between heritage and tribal citizenship, and says only the tribes can determine tribal citizenship. And she says she respects that and says that's why she doesn't list herself now in the Senate as Native American.
So obviously the big question here, she's been dealing with this for at least 6 years. Does this make this go away? Does it put it to rest?
In a word, no. I mean, although Warren insists she's not running for president in 2020, she made that point again today. The assumption by many is that she is positioning herself for the run. And my guess is that her opponents, certainly President Trump, who likes to refer to her derisively as Pocahontas, is going to continue to bring this up, even in spite of this reporting by the Globe.
All right, so let's switch gears here and talk quickly about the 7th Congressional District. The candidates were there at the Labor Day breakfast. What was their message today, a day before the primary?
All right, so this pits the 10-term Congressman Michael Capuano against Boston City Councilwoman Ayanna Pressley. And it's an interesting race because they're both progressives. They would probably vote the same way on most issues in Congress. But Pressley says she's the first, as the first African-American woman to be elected to the Boston City Council, she's arguing that she is a movement builder, will bring a different perspective to the state's only majority-minority district. So here's a bit of what she was saying today.
There are a lot of people that are uncomfortable and don't like that I'm in this race. They find it disruptive, and some of them even think it traitorous. But democracy is about choice, and after a generation, this district deserves one. The district has changed. The needs of the district have changed. And given what's happening in Washington, so has the job description.
So, Chris, as you know, this contest has been compared in some ways to the Joe Crowley-Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez race in New York. There's some differences, though. Unlike Crowley, Capuano is a true progressive in his own right. And unlike Ocasio-Cortez, Presley is not a political newcomer. But she is part of a record surge of women and candidates of color running for Congress who say the Democratic Party needs to open up and broaden its reach.
Capuano, unlike Crowley, actually showed up for his debates as well.
That's a key difference as well.
So how is the congressman responding? What was his message?
So he addressed the Labor Day breakfast and really talked about the important alliance between organized labor and the Democratic Party and how over the years Republicans have successfully eroded the power of unions. And he really urged Democrats and organized labor to recommit to working together to help the working class. As for Ayanna Pressley, this is the first time in 20 years he's had a real challenge, and he's taken it seriously.
I have never entered a campaign in my life where I have asked other people to support me when I'm not willing to do all the work possible. When I first heard my opponent, I walked away from a personal vacation. No big deal. It's just that's when the bell went off. And I've been working very hard for 8 months, and I think the results are going to be seen on Tuesday.
Now, our most recent polling, as you know, suggests that Capuano has an edge in this race. But, there are signs that this race is tightened. And as we've said again and again, this is going to come down to voter turnout and a primary election day, the day after Labor Day. Tough time to get people to focus and out to the polls, but it's going to happen tomorrow.
Well, that's Anthony Brooks, WBUR senior political reporter. Anthony, thanks so much for joining us.
My pleasure, Chris.
All right, for more on the most significant races going on around the state, we turn now to Lauren Dozensky. She's reporter for Political Massachusetts and author of the Massachusetts Playbook. Lauren, welcome back to Radio Boston.
Thank you for having me.
And also with us is Joe Battenfeld, political columnist for the Boston Herald. Joe, thanks for being here.
Thanks, Chris.
So let's pick off there in the race between Capuano and Pressley. It's captured some real national attention. There was a New York Times article this weekend titled, "Mike Capuano is in the political fight of his life." What's your take on the race?
Well, I think I have a feeling this is going to race is more hype than actual race. I have yet to see a poll that shows Pressley in single digits even. And she has not been able to afford a single TV ad. Maybe a Spanish language ad or something,
right.
But I don't think she's had a widespread TV buy. I've yet to see any evidence that Capuano is actually weak. You need a weak incumbent to beat somebody like this. You need somebody to be weak and to be unpopular. He's, in fact, very popular, so I haven't seen any signs that her campaign has been able to take him down a notch. But that being said, a lot depends on turnout, and who knows, if we get an unexpected burst of turnout of progressives, this could be a close race. I just don't see it right now.
Lauren, what do you think?
Yeah, I think it's interesting because this race itself has kind of captured the national imagination, at least in terms of people nationally who are really, really obsessed with politics and really want to parse what the potential future of the Democratic Party could look like.
It's been called the battle for the soul of the Democratic Party.
Exactly. And to a certain extent, I don't know that I personally would go that far. Having covered this and been being on the ground, this is honestly a little bit more of a battle for the face of the Democratic Party. What does the future of the Democratic Party looks like? Like you guys talked about in the piece earlier, is there a wave of a woman who kind of looks like the district a little bit more? That, I think, is really kind of encapsulating what this race looks like. And it kind of goes back to the national attention. Even this morning at this Greater Boston Labor Council breakfast, both Pressley and Capuano were there, as well as a bunch of national reporters. So there's clearly a lot of attention with whatever happens in this race.
Yeah, we talked about it in our Week in Review on Friday, and there isn't a real strong difference on many policy issues at all. Joe, do you think there's any impact here for the Democratic Party based on the results?
I think there's an impact locally, you know, for the delegation. It's rare that it's unheard of, in fact, for an incumbent Democrat to get challenged by a member of her own of his own party or her own party. So I think there's going to be impact locally. Nationally, I think the National Press Corps has swarmed all over this race because maybe there's not been a lot to do. Maybe there's been a brief pause in the race. But I think that, you know, there's significantly, I think Lauren is right. This is a battle for the face of the party more than the actual ideology.
All right. Well, let's come back to what we started the show talking about. That is Senator Elizabeth Warren, a big article in the Boston Globe yesterday, basically saying that all of these questions about her heritage, they did not affect her professional career, that she was always considered a white applicant at all of the schools that she was hired at. Joe, I'll start with you. What's your reaction?
I'm sorry, but an article by the Boston Globe clearing Elizabeth Warren based on documents that Warren gave them does not do it for me. I think until she answers the question, she has yet to answer the question, why? Why did you do it? Why did you call yourself? Why did you list yourself as a minority? Because she did.
Well, she has said that they've had this family lore.
She's white. She's white. She's not a minority. She's clearly not a minority. Why did even if she has, and I don't know, nobody knows the question of her claims of Native American ancestry. I think, you know, we can debate that. But even if she is part Native American, it's 1/32nd or some very minute amount. Nobody would ever claim themselves to be a minority in this position. So why did you do it?
But if she was considered a white applicant by all of the folks doing the hiring at her number of jobs, then does it matter?
It does matter. It does matter. It goes to her personal, why did she do it? Morals, I guess, or ethics, I would say. Why did you list? Why would you list yourself? And Harvard clearly tried to take advantage of it because they listed her as a minority in their directories right after. And
yeah,
Harvard Crimson did a story based, we have a Native American professor now, Elizabeth Warren. So they clearly took advantage of it afterwards.
So the other why question I think that comes to everybody's mind, and Anthony mentioned that he had asked Senator Warren herself, why now? Is there a reason that you think this is the time to try to confront this story?
Yeah, it's always kind of suspect when a question that has been lingering for more than 6 years kind of in this national conversation and even local conversation, why was it answered now? As far as any of us can tell, this wasn't exactly an issue in Senator Warren's Senate race as she's about to face whoever wins the Republican primary tomorrow. For all intents and purposes, I don't think it's unfair to say that these tea leaves would indicate that Senator Warren envisions a more significant national platform for herself. If she wants to attempt to answer this question or have proof to answer this question, there's clearly she and her people see a reason for this question to be asked, right? Like if she is going out to Iowa or Nevada or New Hampshire or wherever else, this allows her to point to the paperwork and the documentation and say, listen, I already answered this question. What else are we going to talk about?
Okay, so I want to, go ahead, Joe.
No, I was going to say, and this is a change in strategy from the Warren campaign. Before this, they had always tried to ignore the story, and any questions about it were just like put off, like, how dare you ask her again about this? She's answered the question. She's not going to talk about it. But now, all of a sudden, she's giving speeches to Native American groups. She's doing this exhaustive investigation. So they're clearly trying to confront it as a prelude to her running for president.
All right. Well, that is Joe Battenfeld. He's a political columnist for the Boston Herald. Joe, thanks so much for joining us. Appreciate it. And Lauren Dzinski, reporter for Politico Massachusetts and author of the Massachusetts Playbook. Lauren, thanks to you as well.
Thank you.
Stay with us. Coming up, how can human workers stay relevant in a world full of robots and artificial intelligence? Interesting question on this Labor Day. I'm Chris Sidorek. This is Radio Boston. Thanks for listening to the Radio Boston podcast. If you'd like to support WBUR, go to radioboston.org and click the pledge button in the upper right-hand corner. Okay, back to the show.
Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Chris Siderick. Since it's Labor Day, we're going to spend the rest of the show today thinking about the future of work. And we've talked a lot through the years here at Radio Boston about this idea that the robots are coming. They're coming for my job, for your job, and quite frankly, for a whole lot of jobs in the very near future. Long story short, anything that can be automated probably will be. So how do we really prepare young people, new workers entering their careers for the first time, for that jobless future? That's something Joseph Aoun, president of Northeastern University, has been thinking a lot about. He says it's time for higher education to consider reprogramming itself, if colleges and universities are really going to prepare students for the needs of a future economy. He lays out his ideas on how to do that in his book, Robot Proof: Higher Education in the Age of Artificial Intelligence. Aoun joined Meghna Chakrabarty back in November of last year when the book first came out. And they began with some of the fundamental things that he thinks need to change about higher education.
I think the higher education has the ingredients, and the whole idea is to put them together in a different way in order to make people robot-proof. Specifically, what I'm advocating for is a new curriculum that is what I call humanics, is focusing on the integration of three literacies. Every student should master the first literacy, obviously the tech literacy. Mm-hmm. How do machines and computers work? How can we interact with them? And we have to learn that aspect. The second literacy is the data literacy. We have to understand this enormous amount of information generated by computers and by smart machines, and we need to navigate that and make sense of it. Mm-hmm. And the third is the human literacy. Namely, every learner have to understand what makes us unique as human beings, namely the ability to be creative, to be entrepreneurial, to be innovative, the ability to be empathetic with other people, the ability to be culturally agile, to be global. And the integration of the three literacies will prepare us to be robot-proof.
Okay.
But then the other question is going to be how to achieve that.
Right. I was going to say, practically speaking, what would that look like?
Well, for instance, what I am saying is that what we have to focus on is what makes humans unique with respect to machines, all these attributes that I mentioned to you before. But take creativity, take innovation, take entrepreneurship, take empathy, take cultural agility. How to achieve that? You don't achieve them by being in a course only and studying that. You don't become an entrepreneur or innovator or creator by being in a course. You have to practice that yourself. And this is where experiential education is key. So the second ingredient is experiential education. What is experiential education? It's the ability to integrate your classroom experience with the world experience.
I mean, is it something like Northeastern's co-op program?
The co-op programs, those internships that will allow you to be testing yourself, to understand what you're good at, to understand what you like, to be able to work with other people, to see what makes them move, what makes them is sad, what makes them happy, to be empathetic with them, to work in an environment that is global, that is culturally diverse. All these aspects happen in an experiential mode, such as co-op. Absolutely.
So let me ask you, I am very strongly persuaded by your underlying thesis here that the workers of the future or citizens of the future will need to be lifelong learners and have these sort of three prongs in terms of their approach to the world, the tech, the data, and the human literacy, especially the idea of being able to synthesize all that together.
Absolutely.
Having a facility and an agility, right? To apply their human creativity to all sorts of problems. But I wonder, again, practically speaking, beyond the experiential part, what does the college campus of the future look like? Is there going to be a history department? Is there going to be an engineering school? I mean, or are all those silos, should they go away?
Well, the silos by definition should go away. Those silos are relatively recent in our history. You know, when knowledge started increasing, we had silos. And now it's time to do the integration. But you ask me how is the college of the future going to look like? Jobs are going to disappear. Various studies are indicating that close to 50% of the jobs will disappear in the next 20 years. Others will be transformed, and new jobs will arise. So people will have to be in a lifelong situation constantly. But somebody who is already working, like you and me, and we need to retool. We don't have the luxury to go back to a campus. Mm-hmm. We don't have the luxury to spend a year or two in a campus. The campus, the university has to come to us. The university has also to come to us and provide us with what we need based on our time, based on our need. So therefore, the campus of the future is a campus where personalization is going to be with you, where you are going to see the various universities becoming multi-universities, being there where you are, wherever you are, and providing you with whatever you need.
Through online learning?
Online is not enough.
Okay.
You know, we know that now various studies have shown that online is not enough. You need to be hybrid, namely online and experience, and also have the one-on-one interaction with people. And that's why, online has not been the solution that everybody was expecting.
Yeah. So, President Ouwen, I have to ask you, the idea that we should all be lifelong learners, absolutely true. But I'm also hearing a little bit of this as sort of the expansion of the role of higher education in all of our lives. And to me, one of the first responses I have is, that sounds really expensive. I mean, we already have a student debt problem here. How do we expect people to continuously go back to school repeatedly over...
Because what's happening now when you go, this idea of lifelong learning is not about spending a year or two. You are seeing the onset and the beginning of boot camps, micro-credentials, badges. So people can afford that. And, when you look at the price point for those offerings, they are extremely reasonable. In fact, prices have been going down from this perspective. So that's an investment that is going to pay off in a very big way.
But in an op-ed, I believe last year in the Washington Post, you also wrote that you would hope that the federal government would be more creative in how it views its funding of higher education.
Absolutely, because we haven't invested in lifelong learning. Other countries are focusing on lifelong learning because they are extremely worried about the impact of robots and intelligent systems job creation and also job disappearance. So they are working on real policies and laws that will allow people to reeducate themselves, reskill themselves. We had more of a laissez-faire attitude here, saying the problem will solve itself. Well, the problem is not going to solve it itself if 50% of the jobs that we know will disappear.
Hmm. It seems like the blueprint that you've laid out is achievable for Northeastern, Harvard, MIT, UMass, big established schools that have the connections in the business world. They have a variety of educators and research departments within their campuses, et cetera. But I wonder, where does this leave, the small liberal arts school that may not have the facilities and resources that Northeastern does?
Well, what you are seeing is that the liberal arts schools are waking up to this enormous challenge and enormous opportunity. And so you are seeing various liberal arts schools integrating an experiential dimension on purpose in order to meet the needs of the students and make them robot-proof for life. So the liberal arts schools understand that this is an enormous opportunity for them, and that is something that is very laudable.
Mm. Now, for the sake of argument, let me ask you, what about the person out there who may be listening who says, I just want to study, I'll throw this out there, history. I just want to be an expert in 12th century South Asian history. What's so wrong with that?
There's nothing wrong with that. Quite the opposite. As a matter of fact, I mentioned that every learned citizen has to integrate three literacies. The tech literacy, the data literacy, and the human literacy. So let's go back to your point about history. history now, the study of history, the study of humanities, is being transformed by all the computational aspects. You are hearing digital humanities. What is it? It's the integration of all these computational tools that will allow you to understand literature, history, creativity. And that's what's happening. So quite the opposite. No one can afford not to integrate the three literacies. And the three literacies will allow you to enlighten your field of study, whether it is in pure technology or whether it's in the humanities or the social sciences. Mm.
Do you really think, just to kind of circle back to what I was asking you about smaller liberal arts schools, I want to press you on this a little bit, because do you really think that every institution of higher education in the United States can survive this transformation, if indeed it's what's needed for higher ed?
Look, you know, some liberal arts colleges, actually various liberal arts colleges, are being challenged. You are seeing waves of mergers, acquisitions, closure. And why? Because, in fact, they haven't kept up with what the needs of society and the needs of the learner. So the opportunity is precisely to move into this new domain, namely make people robot-proof by offering the humanities curriculum and experiential component. And that's what we are seeing the liberal arts schools experimenting with. Mm. Not everyone is doing that, but those who are, I think, are reaping already the benefit.
Yeah. You know, when it comes to education and its fundamental role in sort of our future society and economy, I can't help but to wonder, though, if focusing on higher ed, I mean, that's your world, so obviously you're going to do that. But it also seems like it's too late, right? If we wait until someone's 18, and also this being a person who has the wherewithal and the funding to be able to go to a college or university, which isn't everybody, if we wait until then for them to experience this humanics kind of curriculum, is it almost not too late? Should we also be looking further upstream?
You're absolutely right. What are we doing? What is higher education doing for the K to 12? For instance, at Northeastern, what we have done is we have brought 70 schools from the United States and Canada precisely to try to integrate and work on the experiential component in their schools. So we need to be more active, more present, because that's a pipeline issue and that's a responsibility issue.
When you talk about this on Northeastern's campus, do you get any pushback from anybody, or is everyone pretty much on board saying this is the direction we need to go?
I mean, the whole academic plan at Northeastern, what we call Northeastern 2025, has been based on that.
Right.
And therefore, you know, the people who shape the academic plan are the faculty, the students, the staff, and, you know, the employers, 3,000 employers that we work with. Say, you know, some of them were at the table to shape it with us. So there is a buy-in, because this has been shaped by the community.
Otherwise, higher ed itself won't be robot-proof, right? Because it seems like those opportunities in that education can come from elsewhere.
Absolutely. And you are seeing that happening as we speak. You are seeing that companies and firms are establishing their own universities. They call it, you know, the IBM University, the GE University. And then when you talk to them, you ask them, why are you doing that? They say to you, this is not our core competence, but we're doing it because no one is meeting our needs. We need a lifelong learning opportunities for the people in our companies. And therefore, as you said, if we don't do it, it's going to be done, and it's not going to be done as well.
That's Joseph Ahun, president of Northeastern University, speaking with Meghna Chakrabarty back in November of 2017. Ahun's book is Robot Proof: Higher Education in the Age of Artificial Intelligence. Stay with us. After the break, we'll hear about the future of robotics from the former director of MIT's Computer Science and Artificial Intelligence Laboratory and the founder of iRobot, Rodney Brooks. I'm Chris Siderick, and this is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Chris Siderick. Before the break, we heard from Northeastern President Joseph Aoun on higher education and the future of work. And finally, on this Labor Day, we want to hear from one other thought leader on our robotic future, Rodney Brooks. He's the former director of MIT's Computer Science and Artificial Intelligence Laboratory. He's also co-founder of two companies, iRobot, maker of the Roomba, and now Rethink Robotics. In other words, he's someone who's spent his entire life thinking about robots and artificial intelligence, and he's someone who's helping to bring that future to us. Back in 2016, Meghna Chakrabarty sat down with Rodney Brooks to talk about where he thinks robotic technology is headed. And they began at the beginning for Brooks, as a small boy in 1950s Australia, making circuits out of tin cans and light bulbs.
I came from a family that no one had come close to finishing high school. They didn't know anyone who had a university degree. And by age four, everyone called me the professor because I could do things with numbers and arithmetic that could beat all the adults. So I was fascinated by numbers and the patterns with them. And then the circuits were sort of putting those patterns into something physical and being able to do more with them and then just play with them in my head and on pieces of paper.
Yeah. Okay. So clearly there was more going on in your internal circuitry than for most of us at a young age.
Yeah, and I have no explanation for that. I say I won a genetic lottery somehow.
And was it at this time? How old were you when you created Norman?
All through my childhood, I tried to build computers. And I wanted to build robots, but I wasn't good at building mechanical stuff. Finally, when I was about 16 or 17, I built a robot I called Norman.
And I understand that, like so many people who are drawn to robotics, that you had... Is revelation too much too powerful of a phrase to use when you saw 2001?
2001 was, the movie was incredibly inspiring to me because I was sort of working by myself, and then to see this vision of this intelligent machine in the future and what it might be, you know, it was a murdering psychopath, but apart from that, it was just exciting. And it was really a vision of the future, which was fantastic.
Well, so then you went to college in Australia, but you ended up going to Stanford to do your PhD, right?
Correct. And I landed in Silicon Valley before it was really known as Silicon Valley in 1977. Mm-hmm. And things were just starting to heat up then, so it was a great time to be there. And if I'd tried to come a few years later, I wouldn't have got accepted into the computer science department at Stanford. It was still so small, they'd take people who would apply and... So I was lucky to get there then.
When you were in grad school, could you foresee, based on the research that was going on then, where we would be today?
I thought we'd be further along in some ways.
Uh-huh.
And I didn't imagine lots of other things. At that time, I knew of three mobile robots in the world that were, you know, professional mobile robots that people actually had. I then went on here in Boston to co-found iRobot,
right.
And iRobot has sold over 16 million mobile robots. I couldn't imagine that number back then. I couldn't imagine having 16 million mobile robots. That was unimaginable. But I probably thought they would be smarter than they are today.
Uh-huh. Okay. And so why aren't they as smart as you thought they would be?
It turns out artificial intelligence is really, really hard, and we hardly understand anything despite what some people say in the press. It's really hard. We know almost nothing. Almost nothing.
So this is really interesting because it seems as if the popular imagination, the popular consciousness, we think that artificial intelligence is very far along and that, you know, actually, in the last year or two, there's been all this coverage about, you know, robots are going to take your job and this, that, and the other. Even white collar workers, look out. I hear you saying that that's wrong.
Well, I don't blame the media for this. I actually think there's a bunch of...
If we need to accept the blame, we shall. I'll let you know.
I think there's a bunch of scientists and engineers who are not in AI who've misinterpreted AI. And I think people in general misinterpret AI. And let me, if I may, explain
what
I think the fundamental mistake people make. When a person does some performance of some sort, we've got a pretty good model of how that performance generalizes to other things. When a computer does the performance, it may not generalize in the same way. So go back to the 90s. We had Deep Blue beat the world chess champion, Kasparov.
Mm-hmm.
And now you can get any number of different programs for a laptop or even your phone which have a higher chess rating than any person in the world in history. But a chess grandmaster is pretty good at teaching someone how to play chess better and coaching them. All these programs can do is say best move, not best move. They don't understand in the same way a person understands. A grandmaster, if someone's a grandmaster, you'd expect them to be able to play tic-tac-toe. Those chess playing programs can't play tic-tac-toe. They can't play any other game. They don't even know they're playing a game. So they've got this very, very narrow performance. 2 years ago, there was a deep learning came about. And deep learning is a technique in AI. It's been around for about 30 years, but it finally got good enough. Amazon Echo, it understands your speech much better than they used to. That's because of deep learning. And there was a story in the New York Times showing deep learning labeling images and saying what's in an image. So there in the New York Times was a picture that had been labeled as people playing Frisbee in a park. And indeed, you look at it, people are playing Frisbee in a park. It did well. But if a person had written in Japanese the equivalent of people playing Frisbee in a park, you'd expect some other Japanese speaker to be able to ask them a bunch of questions that they could answer, like how many people are in the park? Where are the people in the image? What are they looking at? Where's the Frisbee in the image? What's a Frisbee? The person who could answer in Japanese would be able to answer all those questions. All the image labeling program can do is say people playing Frisbee in a park. It knows nothing else. You can't go any deeper with it.
Okay. So what's the barrier then to that depth of knowledge? Is it just a matter of time and complexity and computing power? Or is it, because I heard you say earlier that these programs don't even know what they're doing. Is it a question of consciousness?
These programs are not sentient in any way like
yet.
A person. but they have no intent. They have no intent. And no one I know of in the world is working on sentience or a program having intent. You know, I worked on that a little bit 20-some years ago. Didn't go anywhere. So what's happening right now and what's being driven by large companies, the AI that's being built is good at transactional mm-hmm. sorts of things. So some very specialized jobs, medical jobs like radiographers, will be displaced by these algorithms. But the doctor who talks to the person and examines them and takes their history and deeply understands them and understands, oh, this person is motivated by some psychological thing and is miseating for this reason, that sort of stuff is not going to be taken away. Mm-hmm. So it's the deeper understanding of how things fit together is not being tackled at all by the AI systems
okay.
at the moment.
So then tell me about the creation of iRobot.
It started out as a space exploration company. Mm. We were going to send robots to the moon and to Mars. That was our plan.
But you're best known for sending robots to vacuum people's carpets.
Eventually, we did.
I don't say that facetiously in the pejorative. It's one product which showed that sort of the possibility of robotics at a consumer level in a way that nothing else had, which is very important in terms of how we view robotics as part of our lives. But anyway, go ahead.
We founded iRobot, and for many years we didn't have a real business model. We had lots and lots of different things. We worked with various governments for government funding. We worked with the Japanese government to do nuclear power plant inspection robots for a while. We were a little early on some things and a little naive on other things, and eventually in 2002 we got two business models that worked all at once, the Roomba, mm-hmm. the vacuum cleaning robot, and the PackBot, which is a robot to, under remote operation, go into bad areas and look around. They were the robots that went into Fukushima, but originally they were used in Afghanistan to look into the caves, and then in Iraq to go and poke the roadside bombs and save the soldiers from having to go out and deal with them, have the robots get rid of them.
So actually that makes me wonder, do you think that in terms of robotics that we might come into more frequent contact with in our daily lives, that is it going to be through first through the, like you said, the military applications before we see the robots that, you know, science fiction currently presents in movies?
Well, I think right now what we're seeing is the robotification of cars,
right,
with driver assist features.
Right.
I'm not as optimistic as some people that we're going to have fully self-driving cars everywhere anytime real soon, but other things in our lives will become robotic. You know, there won't be the science fiction robot, the Rosie of the Jetsons,
yeah,
but there will be robotic capabilities.
So actually, I should probably just ask you a very basic question, that when we say today robot or robotics, what do you think that means?
Well, I've tried to come up with a definition of robot that I use. A robot to me is something which senses the world around it, does some sort of computation, and then takes some action outside of its own body, changes the world outside of its own body. And I say outside of its own body because I don't want a dishwasher to be a robot. Mm. That seems too trite. But a Roomba picks up dirt. A Tesla moves people around.
And so in that sense, I mean, ultimately, there should be no limit to, as time goes by and technology develops, there should be no limit to what, under that definition, a robotic device could do, right?
In principle, I see no limit. You know, I think modern science says that we are mechanisms. We are built out of molecules and chemistry, and they obey laws that we've partially identified, and we arise out of that. So in principle, one might be able to build a machine out of other material. There is a question whether we're smart enough, uh-huh, to build such a machine. Professor Patrick Winston at MIT, for many years I co-taught the artificial intelligence course with him. He still teaches it. And he used to always start by saying that when he was growing up in Illinois, he had a pet raccoon which could get out of any cage. It was able to manipulate stuff and get out of the cage. And he said, but I never thought that it was smart enough to build a copy of itself.
Uh-huh.
So I've had this view of, you know, aliens sitting up in space watching us and saying, oh, look at those little MIT professors. They think they're going to build copies of themselves. Aren't they silly? They're too stupid to do that. So we don't know how smart we are. We think we're really smart, but we may not be smart enough.
The building a copy of ourselves possibility. I mean, should that be a goal for us?
I don't think myself that's a goal. Some people treat it as a goal. But it's so far in the future, in, yeah, my view. It's not around the corner,
right,
as some people think. Some people get all worked up about it and say, we've got to worry about these super intelligent robots. But they're not even close to being even badly intelligent yet, you know, poorly intelligent.
Well, these some people that you're talking about, though, are, at least as far as we've read, Elon Musk, because we were talking about Teslas before, Stephen Hawking, Bill Gates. I mean, they've specifically...
Bill pulled back a little bit.
True. And they also had a specific warning about weaponized robots and hyper-artificial intelligence with that.
Well, it was hyper-artificial... But some of their colleagues have talked about robots being too literal, and you say... tell the robot to make a lot of paper clips and it just takes all the metal in the world and makes paper clips. You're not going to build a system like that. Because before a robot was super intelligent and did bad things, there'd be ones that weren't quite so intelligent and did stupid things. And before that, there'd be stupid robots which did bad things. So it's a process.
I take your point about the evolution of the technology, and I definitely take that to heart because it's true. I mean, it's not, we don't see the technological equivalent of punctuated equilibrium, I suppose. But with the smartphone example, though, it does bring up the other side of the coin to that, which is, you know, it was just a couple years ago where the first smartphone was introduced, and it has had a high-speed, powerful impact on the way everyone lives. And I suppose that's the kind of thing that people, when it comes to robotics, are similarly, not everyone's concerned, but they wonder about, that when that change point happens, what will it mean for us?
I think the smartphone is a great example because the smartphone was built on top of a whole bunch of other technology, which has been quite astounding. So it didn't come all at once. But another thing that it shows is it's been said that people overestimate technology in the short term and underestimate it in the long term.
Uh-huh.
So this thing about robots being super intelligent and being nasty is overestimating the short term.
Well, on that point, I think it was Stephen Hawking who wrote that in the short term, the impact of artificial intelligence depends on who controls it, but in his mind, in the long term, it depends on whether it can be controlled at all. I mean, again, that's a nightmare scenario.
Yeah, but I think that's a little like worrying about overpopulation of Mars. We don't know what it's going to look like. And by the way, Stephen Hawking and Elon Musk and Max Tegmark, the physicist, and Nick Bostrom and other people, none of them work in AI. None of them understand AI. It's like me being worried about black holes. You know, Stephen Hawking is studying black holes. And, you know, I know from Heisenberg that when you look at one of those things, you change it. So maybe you shouldn't be studying it because the black holes will come and eat us all. That's stupid. But that's sort of, I think, the level of their argument.
Yeah. So let's talk about the present day state of the technology. I mean, what do you think are some of the more or most compelling potential uses for robotics in the next 5 years?
Well, I think what's going to drive robotics over the next 30 years is the demographic inversion in the world, the aging population. Uh-huh. But here's an example. In southern Denmark, around Odense, there are people who go to government workers who go to people's homes and clean the homes. But they require that the person have a robot vacuum cleaner so that the government worker is able to be much more efficient cleaning the older people's homes for them than doing it all by hand. So there's an example of a robot being pulled into elder care, not directly. It's not being a companion to the person, but it's letting them have clean homes through some assistance program.
So you've spent a good part of your career here in Massachusetts, and I'm just wondering what your take is on the state of your corner of the tech industry in Massachusetts right now.
Well, I think Massachusetts is the place for robotic startups. You know, you see Amazon, for instance, bought Kiva Systems, and now it's become Amazon Robotics, and it's got multiple sites, and they're hiring like crazy. You know, maybe the venture capital community here wasn't, you know, didn't produce the social networking companies, but it did produce the robotics companies.
One last thing, because I just... you know, because we've been talking about how no matter what people on average think, we haven't come all that far in artificial intelligence. But do you think that one day it will be possible to create robots that have emotion or a semblance of emotion?
We don't really understand where the separation is between inanimate and animate. Mm-hmm. And I refer to it as the juice. What is the juice of life? And, you know, it's sort of a joke to call it the juice because I think it's just mechanistic. It's sort of like, you know, at one point we didn't know calculus. And then once we knew calculus, we could do all new sorts of things. We don't know even what the right questions are to get us there yet. So I think that in my lifetime, in your lifetime, in your children's lifetime, we're not going to see those sorts of devices. We're in Greek mathematics. We don't even understand that calculus is needed yet.
That's Rodney Brooks, the former director of MIT's Computer Science and Artificial Intelligence Laboratory. He's also co-founder of two robotics companies, iRobot, maker of the Roomba, and now Rethink Robotics. He spoke with Meghna Chakrabarty back in the summer of 2016. And don't forget, listeners, tomorrow is primary day in Massachusetts. Lots of races for both Democrats and Republicans across the state. WBUR has a comprehensive voter guide for the Massachusetts primaries, including links to make sure you are registered before you get to the polls, how to find out your local polling location, and information about your district. And don't forget to join us at 8 p.m. for our special coverage of primary results. That'll be hosted by WBUR's Bob Oakes. We'll have our reporters in the field and our analysts in the studio to help you make sense of it all. And I hope you'll join us again tomorrow on Radio Boston. We'll speak with William Gross, the newly appointed commissioner of the Boston Police Department. Commissioner Gross was the superintendent in chief of the BPD under former Commissioner Bill Evans. He was sworn in last month. We'll ask Commissioner Gross about body cameras for Boston police officers, the criminal justice reform efforts in Massachusetts, and a number of other issues facing the BPD. That's our show for today. Radio Boston is a production of 90.9 WBUR, Boston's NPR news station.
Our show is produced by Jamie Bologna, Paris Alston, and Zoe Mitchell. Tim Skoog is our technical director. We had engineering help today from Matt Lissette. Our executive producer is Hitesh Hathi. I'm Chris Siderick. This is Radio Boston.